Okay, welcome everybody to the Sutta class for today, and we have decided to do for the next year reading that's from the Majjhima Nikaya, from 1 through till 50, and or 52. There's actually 52 suttas in the first. I wonder if that was actually chosen to be the first 52 weeks of the year. Wouldn't be surprised. Anyway, so now you have no excuse for not reading the sutta before the class, and nor have I, incidentally. So it is a good thing to do to, you'll know which sutta we're going to be doing in advance, and to have a look through it, even if you've read it before, to read through, refresh it, and this is the way that we really learn something deeply, not just by reading it quickly or one time, but by reading it many times, contemplating it deeply, and each time coming back to it and trying to learn a little bit more. And those of us who've had a kind of a love affair with the suttas for many years, then this is something that we keep on finding. The nature of the teachings in the suttas is very elusive, it's very suggestive, and it tends to open up a lot of questions and avenues for understanding rather than closing them down. And so even though we're baffled, we're puzzled, because the suttas might express sometimes very profound things in a very succinct way, a very concise way that's quite hard to understand, and it takes a lot of unpacking. We're maybe more used to a style of writing which is more discursive and more rounds things out, fills them out, explains themselves as they go along. And the suttas often aren't like that. And very often we find it's a bit frustrating. Sometimes the things which are most profound and most interesting are treated the most briefly. And those things which seem to be painfully obvious are repeated again and again and again. Perhaps this is because the intelligent ones were able to understand the profound teachings, even though they were only given very briefly, but the stupid ones had to have the very simple teachings explained to them again and again and again and again. There might be something to that. In any case, when we're reading the suttas, something which is difficult and quite problematic, of course the Buddha wasn't an author. And it's actually like all of the founders of the great wisdom traditions, whether Socrates or Jesus or Muhammad, none of them were writers, and all of them, their sayings were remembered by their students and passed down. In Christianity, this is well known, and it's there's a kind of an active branch of Christian scholarship which investigates the extent to which what we call Christianity is in fact Paulinism, since it was through St. Paul that we actually have our earliest records of what Jesus was about. Of course, St. Paul never actually met Jesus, and yet effectively what we know about Jesus we know through St. Paul. In the same way, we might wonder to what extent what we think of as Buddhism is actually, perhaps it's Anandism. Perhaps it's actually the teachings of Ananda that we're passing down. And so far within Buddhist circles, there's been little understanding or little reflection on the nature and the means in which the tradition has shaped and altered and left its fingerprints on the textual materials which we've inherited. Usually, within Buddhist circles, of course, the emphasis is on asserting again and again that these are the original suttas and the original teachings of the Buddha and so on and so forth. And there's certainly a degree of fear and concern about questioning this. And so as those of you who've known my teachings over the last few years would know, it's not a fear which I share. And I think it's extremely important that we ask these kinds of questions and that we learn to read critically. And that doesn't mean, reading critically doesn't mean reading with a fault-finding mind, but it means reading very, very carefully and with that attitude of being a vibhajavadana, someone who is an analyst or makes distinctions, and so we're able to read intelligently. And in doing that, of course, the key, the most important thing is being able to read the texts in comparative light, and that means usually reading the text together with the corresponding versions found in Chinese translation, sometimes also found in Sanskrit or Tibetan, but the vast majority of corresponding suttas found in Chinese. And so for these readings, we're lucky enough to have the excellent notes and studies done on the topic by Venerable Analoya. So I'll be relying on these for information as to any kind of variations that we might be finding in the Chinese suttas. Occasionally, if we can, we'll do some independent research, but I'm certainly not going to. Unfortunately, I should do. If I was to be very rigorous and careful, then I would go back and look at it all myself, but I don't really have the time or the ability to do that, so we'll have to be relying on Venerable Analoya. Hopefully we can check his reasoning as we go. Another very important thing to bear in mind when reading the suttas, and this is something which is a problem which I come up against constantly when talking to people about the suttas, is that there's a almost chronic inability to give the text its due, okay? And it seems that in Buddhist circles, perhaps more widely, I'm not so familiar, but certainly within Buddhist circles, people are in a tremendous rush to leap from a cursory and simplistic reading of a text to the most profound and abstruse conclusions about what it really means. And people are quite happy to say, well, you know, this proves that such and such is wrong, or this is right, or the commentary is wrong, or that Mahayana is wrong, or that this is wrong, or this is right, on the basis of very, very simplistic and very shallow readings of a text. And perhaps this is more problematic in Buddhism than in some other traditions. Within the Christian tradition, it has been more of a text-based tradition, so actual Bible reading is regarded as one of their spiritual practices. Within Buddhism, textual reading is not regarded as a spiritual practice in the same way. And so there's perhaps less respect given to that, and less time and less energy given to actually figuring out what the text itself is trying to say. And so I think it's very important to give the text its due, and give the surface of the text its due, and to spend some time familiarizing oneself with the literal and surface meaning of a text. It doesn't mean you have to stop there. It doesn't mean that all there is to a text is what appears on the surface. But it means that if we want to say anything meaningful, anything that goes more deeply into a text, you know, in a meaningful way, that we have to do that on the basis of a good knowledge of actually what the surface of the text is saying. So this is one of the things that you'll probably notice as we proceed, that I sort of consciously resist attempts to go underneath the text. I resist attempts to leap from statements found in a text written 2,500 years ago to say, how is that relevant for my practice here and now? Of course, it's very important that we ask these questions, but it's not good enough to naively leap from something that we see to what we see now. So rather than doing that, what I'll try to emphasize is like a close reading of the text as it stands, and trying to emphasize reading that in its context. And this is another very important thing which is often overlooked in Buddhist reading of text, is that the Buddha was not speaking in a Buddhist context. He was speaking in an Indian context, where the ideas which were floating around were Brahmanical ideas, they were Jaina ideas, they were various different kinds of philosophies and so on. And very, very often when we meet things in the suttas, we find that there are contexts which are relevant in that time and place, which have become lost or have become disappeared, contexts that we're not familiar with, and contexts which also the commentators were not familiar with. And the later Buddhist traditions we're not familiar with, so that the later Buddhist traditions give explanations for many ideas which are actually ignore or appear to simply not be aware of the likely original context where those ideas were taught. So This week we're talking about the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, and I think we'll probably find examples of all of those different issues in Buddhist textuality in this particular sutta. Mula Pariyaya Sutta is perhaps the most difficult sutta in the Pali Canon. One might have a controversy about whether it is in fact the most difficult or it is merely one of the most difficult. And here it sits right at the beginning of the Majjhima Nikaya. And so in this we're at the mercy of the redactors of the Pali Canon. So, you know, this is a decision which was made at a certain time and place to put the Mula Pariyaya Sutta as sutta number one in the Majjhima Nikaya. Of course, they didn't need to do that. They could well have put it somewhere else. And in fact, in the Chinese, the equivalent sutta in the Majjhima Agama is sutta number 106. So there's no, it's not given a special prominence. And so one might be perhaps, one might wonder whether for some reason within the Pali tradition that this sutta was given a special prominence that it might not have shared in other traditions. So remember, when we're looking at the order and the sequence of the suttas, we are in effect reading the minds of the redactors of the canon, okay, not of the person who's giving the original teaching. Okay, these are decisions made when, perhaps, if we were to put a date on it, we might say maybe it was in Sri Lanka in 20 BC when the canon was first written down. And perhaps it was then that these final decisions about the organization and structure of the canon were made. Or at least we might say we don't have any particularly good evidence that it happened any earlier than that. So placing this sutta at number one, as Bhikkhu Bodhi points out, is similar or is comparable to the position of the Brahmajala Sutta in the Digha Nikaya. So just as the Mula Pariyaya Sutta opens up the Majjhima Nikaya with a very resounding lion's roar, so does the Brahmajala Sutta open up the Digha Nikaya with a resounding lion's roar. And both of these suttas have a lot in common, and as Bhikkhu Bodhi points out, that they both are about clearing the mind of misconceptions before one is ready to listen to the Dhamma. In the Brahmajala Sutta, the clearing of the mind of misconceptions comes more from like a specific listing of the well-known list of 62 kinds of wrong view. In the Mula Pariyaya Sutta, it's more fundamental, more basic than that, and it's focusing more on the perceptual processes which give rise to these various kinds of wrong views rather than the contents of the wrong views themselves. So, our resources for studying this, we have here excellent book by Bhikkhu Bodhi. So if you want to have a look at this sutta in detail, this is one of Bhikkhu Bodhi's classic studies where he gives a long explanatory essay, translates the sutta and then translates the commentary and some bits of the sub-commentary, I believe. Maybe he doesn't have the sub-commentary in this one. No, he has some bits from the sub-commentary as well. So this gives you a very good study guide for the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. In addition, we have Venerable Anadio's study from his unpublished work on comparing the Majjhima Nikaya with the Majjhima Agama and other corresponding suttas, and also some the work that was done, very valuable work by Vietnamese monk Thich Minh Chao, who did this pioneering work on comparing the Pali and Chinese Majjhimas. So these are the main study resources that I'm going to be using for the teaching this afternoon. Any questions so far? Yeah, you can. And also, you know, please feel free to ask questions and things I want these sutta classes to be more like kind of discussions and things like that, so please feel free to ask questions. If I'm giving a Dhamma talk, I always get completely lost. If anyone asks a question or something in the middle of it, I just get totally thrown. I just can't find my thread again afterwards. I sit there feeling like a dumb pig, trying to figure out what I'm supposed to be talking about. But it's sort of classes, it's a bit more, you want to give that chance for the dialogue. So, the Mula Pariyaya Sutta. Who was the Buddha speaking to? It says the Buddha was speaking to a bunch of monks, as usual. And, No bhikkhunis, of course. They wouldn't have understood a profound sutta like this anyway. So. Interestingly enough, there are some suttas in the Chinese where the Pali just mentions the bhikkhus and then the Chinese mentions bhikkhus and bhikkhunis. So I'm not sure if this is the case in this case. This one, according to the Pali, given at Ukatha, the foot of a royal sala tree in the Subhaga Grove, which is a very unusual, it's a very unusual choice of locations. And when we see this kind of unusual location, then we think that there's maybe something a bit special. Why was the Buddha teaching here? What exactly was going on? And interestingly enough, one of the very few other places other places where this setting is mentioned is in the sutta called the Brahmanimantika Sutta of Majjhima 49. And there the Buddha refers to a time when he was staying at Ukatha in the Subhaga Grove. And the Brahmanimantika Sutta has a similar theme in some ways to the Mulapariyaya Sutta. I won't go into that because that will come around in its due course in our studies, but interesting to notice that, and interesting to notice that in that sutta the Buddha is specifically involved in a discussion and a dialogue with the Brahma, with the great Brahma. And so that suggests that perhaps we should investigate whether there is in fact a Brahmanical context involved here. Now, of course, the commentary agrees that that is the case, and so the commentary tells us that this discourse was given to a bunch of Brahmins, which explains certain peculiarities of the text, which we'll get into later on. Before we actually read the text itself, give you some idea of what possibly the Brahmanical context for this might have been. So I want to kind of deconstruct your preconceptions before looking at this, okay? I want you to look at it not from the eyes of modern Western people who've done, you know, been to university or been to school and learnt and all of these kinds of things. And I want you to try to put yourself in the frame of mind of maybe a Brahmin student or something like that who's come to Buddhism and is trying to understand it. How do they think? What kinds of ideas are present in their mind? Now, in this particular dialogue, it's a very important one. This is in the Brihadaranyaka. Now, what's the beginning of it is that Janaka, king of Videha, performed a sacrifice at which many presents were offered to the priests. Brahmins came from Kuru and Panchala. And then Janaka wished to know which of the Brahmins was the most learned in the scripture. And so he enclosed in the pen 1,000 cows, and to the horns of each cow were fastened 10 coins of gold. Okay? So now Janaka, to give a bit of background, Janaka lived a couple of hundred years before the Buddha. There's still a Janakpur in that region of India, which is not far from, it's in Mithila, not far from Vaishali. So he was an actual historical figure. And he figures in a lot of the important dialogues in these early Upanishads, and particularly those dialogues involving the sage Yajñavalkya, who we'll meet in a little while. So Janaka says to all the assembled Brahmins, so they've all come from far and wide, you know, all these great sages have come, and there's 1,000 cows with coins of gold attached to them. That's quite a lot of cows, right? And these Brahmins are thinking, oh, they look like pretty good cows. Right, so then he says, venerable Brahmins, let him of you who is the wisest Brahmana among you take away those cows. But those Brahmins did not dare to take them. So this is like the kind of contest, yeah? It's a bit like the, in the Greek mythology, you have the contest of Paris, where he throws down the golden apple and says, you know, which one of the goddesses not Paris who throws it down, it was, No, the one who threw down the apple was the goddess of conflict. I can't remember her name, but she came into the feast and threw down the golden apple and said, whichever is the fairest, then they have to take the golden apple. And of course, as very difficult, so that they couldn't decide who's the fairest. So then Aphrodite and Hera and Athena had to go, and Zeus chose Paris, the prince of Troy, to make the very difficult decision. So this was the world's first beauty contest, and the three goddesses had to come and parade for him, and all of them, of course, offered all these various bribes and so on. So this is a judgment of Paris, which is, according to the myth, is the cause of the War of Troy. So, anyway. Yeah, this is from the Upanishad. So this is in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. So here we have this competition. So boy, those Brahmins, they must have been looking at each other. Because, you know, 1,000 cows, it's pretty good, right? But if you go up and get it, you know, you're going to really get some stick from the other Brahmins. So, Yajnavalkya said to his pupil, go on, get those cows, drive them away. So he did so. The other Brahmins were enraged and said, how can he declare himself to be the wisest Brahmin among us? So, then Ashvala, the priest of Janaka, asked him, Yajnavalkya, are you indeed the wisest Brahmin among us? Yajnavalkya replied, we bow down to the wisest Brahmana, but we just want to have those cows. So then they decided to question him. And so then there's a series of questions. And so, of course, they start out with more simple questions and then gradually build up to more and more complex questions. And Yajnavalkya, of course, succeeds in answering all of the questions, which gradually build up to be more more and more profound in their implications. Now, there's one... It comes up to a certain time when there's a certain Brahmin lady called Gargi Vachak Navi, who actually ends up asking the highest question. This is the third last question. Gargi asks one, and then Udalika asks another one, and then finally Gargi asks a final one, and she asks the final questions, which actually, upon answering which, she admits defeat. So it's interesting that she plays a very, very prominent role as being like almost the chief of these Brahmins. And so, of course, in some of the Brahminical scriptures, it tells you that you can't teach Brahman to women. But, of course, from scriptures like this, it seems that that wasn't always followed. So the question she asks Yajnavalkya, on what, since all of this here is woven like warp and woof in water, on what, pray, is water woven like warp and woof? So warp and woof being nothing to do with dogs, okay? Warp and being the weaving of the cloth, okay? So even in those days, they used the cloth as the great metaphor. So what is everything this, everything is woven into water. So what is water woven into? Water is woven into air. So what is the air woven into? The sky. What is the sky woven into? The worlds of the Gandharvas. And so on and so forth. He goes through this thing. It's woven into the worlds of the stars, the worlds of the gods, on Prajapati and so on. Finally, on what then are the worlds of Brahma woven? And Yajnavalkya said, Gargi, do not question too much, lest your head fall off. Verily, you are questioning too much about a divinity about which we are not to ask too much. Do not question too much. So she gets silent. So then it goes on the next one. Udalika then asks further questions, again deriving from building on Gargi's questions. So now the question here that Udalika asks him, he who knows that thread and that inner controller indeed knows Brahman. He knows the worlds, he knows the gods, he knows the Vedas, he knows beings, he knows the self, he knows everything. I know it. If you, Yajnavalkya, do not know that thread, that inner controller, and still take away those cows, then your head will fall off. So, they didn't mess around, these guys. I know, O Gautama, that thread and that inner controller, which he says, anyone can say, I know, but you must tell us what you know. And so, Yajnavalkya's answer, air is that thread, and the world, this world, the other world, and so on, are held together by air, which is quite interesting. And then he says, that's okay, Yajnavalkya, but what is this inner controller? And so it comes down to this antarayamin, of course, being the self. Yajnavalkya's answer, he who dwells in the earth, yet is within the earth, whom the earth does not know, whose body the earth is, who controls the earth from within, he is yourself, the inner controller, the immortal. Okay, so this is his answer, beginning with earth. And, you know, when talking like this, if we want to make it comprehensible, then the easiest or the quickest way to understand this is to remember that the earth element as being spoken about often refers to, of course, the earth element within one's own body. Okay, so one thinks about the actual corporeality of one's body, the heaviness of one's body, and the solidity of one's body. So that thing, he who's dwelling inside here, who within the earth does not know whose body the earth is, who controls the earth from within. He is yourself, the inner controller, the immortal. And then he goes on, he who dwells in the water, he who dwells in the fire, who dwells in the sky, in the air, in the heaven, in the sun, in the various quarters of space, in the moon and stars, in the darkness, in the light, who dwells in all beings, in the breath, in the organ of speech, in the eye, the mind, the skin, and so on, dwells in the understanding, and so on and so forth. He is yourself, your inner controller. He is never seen, but he is the seer. He is never heard, but is the hearer. He is never perceived, but is the perceiver. He is never thought, but is the thinker. There is no other seer but he. There is no other hearer but he. There is no other perceiver but he. There is no other thinker but he. He is yourself, the inner controller, the immortal. Everything else is of evil. So this was Yajnavalkya's reply. And at this, Uddalaka Aruni kept silent.
So then are they saying that's the divine, that's immortal, that resides in each human being?
Yeah. So this was, you know, we're very familiar with the that kind of Advaita doctrine, like Tattvangasi, the self and the Brahman. This particular Upanishad, and in particular Yajnavalkya's teachings, are one of the core sources for that whole doctrine. That he was one of the great sages who really first started to look at the self in a much more profound way rather than the very kind of animistic way which was being looked at previously.
Bhante, wasn't Janaka supposed to have been an enlightened ruler? Is that Janaka?
Enlightened in which sense?
Enlightened in a Hindu sense.
Could well have been, yeah. I mean, he was certainly like a royal sage, yeah?
Yeah, there's stories of Hinduism of the Janaka, who's an enlightened ruler, basically. I give it as an example, but you don't have to read. You can still live a worldly life and be enlightened.
Okay, yeah.
Whether it's the same one.
No, I'm sure it would be. I'm sure it would be, yeah. And he figures greatly in the Jatakas as well. Yeah, well, a lot of the Jataka stories feature Janaka, so that's again what shows that he must have been a historical figure. Yeah. So this is like the immediate sort of intellectual environment in which Buddhism was growing on. So I might just briefly have a look at, just to round it off, I'll briefly read Gargi's questions. And Gargi addresses the other Brahmins with a great degree of confidence. She says, I shall ask him two questions. If he answers me these, none of you can defeat him in arguments about Brahman. Okay. And she said, as a warrior son of the Kashis or the Videhas might rise up against you, having strung his unstrung bow and having taken in his hand two pointed foe-piercing arrows, even so, O Yajnavalkya, do I face you with these two questions? Right on. Answer me these. Ask, Gargi, said he. She said, O Yajnavalkya, of which they say, it is above the heaven, it is beneath the earth, that which is between these two, the heaven and the earth, that which the people call the past, the present, and the future, across what is that woven? That which is above the heaven, which is between the earth, that which is between these two, heaven and earth, which people they call the past, present, and the future, that is woven across space. Gargi said, homage to you who have answered this question. Prepare yourself for the other one. Ask, Gargi. Okay, of that which they say, it is above the heaven, it is beneath the earth, that which is between these two, the heaven and earth, that which people call the past, present, and future. It seems like the same question. Hang on. Seems to be asking the same question. Yeah. I'm not quite sure what's going on. I haven't noticed it. I've read this before. I haven't noticed that. But she's actually asking exactly the same question. Anyway, Yajna Malka probably gives a different answer.
Doesn't the other one say it's between heaven and earth?
And this also says that, yeah, it is above the heaven, beneath the earth, but between the two, the heaven and earth, that which people call the past, present, and future. Okay, that which is above the sky, the answer, that which is above the sky, beneath the earth, between the two, people call the past, present, and future. Across, it is woven like space. Okay. That, and then he gives more explanation here. That, O Gargi, then again, probably a textual problem, I imagine here, something going on. But anyway, O Gargi, the knowers of Brahman call this the imperishable, which is the word for imperishable, it's akshara, which also means a, very interesting, the word imperishable means, also means a letter. Yeah? Letter is an imperishable because you can break up words into, words can break them up, but you can't break up the letters. They're indivisible. So the indivisible was used, it was like a metaphor, it's the imperishable.
Except for in Chinese,
yeah. Well, they couldn't have done that in Chinese, yeah. It is neither gross nor fine, neither short nor long, neither glowing red like fire, nor sticky like water. It is neither shadow nor darkness, neither air nor space, unattached, without taste, without smell, without eyes, without ears, without voice, without mind. Without radiance, without breath, without mouth, without measure, having no within and no without. It eats nothing, and nothing eats it. Verily, at the command of that imperishable, O Gargi, the sun and the moon stand in their respective positions. The heaven and earth stand in those in their positions. What are called moments, hours, days and nights, half months, months and years, stand at the command of that imperishable. Some rivers flow to the east, from the snowy mountains, others to the west. And by command of that, men offer sacrifices to the gods. Verily, that imperishable, O Gargi, is unseen, but is the seer, is unheard, but is the hearer, is unthought, but is the thinker, is unknown, but is the knower. There is no other seer but this, there is no other hearer but this, there is no other thinker than this, there is no other knower. But this, by this imperishable, is space woven. At which Gargi says to the Brahmins, Venerable Brahmins, you may think it is a great thing if you get off from him by just bowing to him. Not one of you will defeat him in arguments about Brahman. So, as you can see, a very powerful dialogue. And Yajnavalkya's philosophy, in many ways, probably representing like the high point of the Upanishadic development at that time, in the time of the Buddha. And you can see that he's so much pointing to that which is within, that which is the knower, the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, which is actually knowing everything that's going on outside. And of course, in Buddhism, this being equivalent to like the consciousness, the vijnana, as the self, and being probably the most refined of all the theories of self, which the Buddha wanted to refute. So, having had a look at that, let's just go over to the Mula Pariyaya Sutta and let's read that with the thought in the back of our mind that perhaps this was aimed at a similar kind of audience, or an audience which was familiar with those kinds of teachings that we found there. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Ukatha, at the foot of a royal sala tree in the Subhaga Grove. There the Exalted One addressed the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus! Lord, the bhikkhus replied. The Exalted One said, I will teach you, bhikkhus, the exposition of the root of all dhammas. Listen and attend carefully to what I shall say. Yes, Bhante, they replied, the Exalted One spoke. Okay, so this, of course, is the introduction. Now, let's just do a little bit of basic textual analysis here. What we've just read isn't the sutta, okay? In the Pali, whenever it talks about the suttas, it says, Yepite suttanta tathagata bhasita, okay? That sutta, those suttas which were spoken by the Tathagata. But of course the Buddha isn't actually speaking those words, apart from the words that are in direct quote. He's not actually saying, thus have I heard on one occasion the Blessed One was dwelling in Ukatha, and so on and so forth. These are not the teachings of the Tathagata. These are teachings of traditionally attributed to Ananda. In fact, almost certainly they were not, for various reasons. But Ananda certainly didn't say, thus have I heard. They're teachings which have been passed down to a tradition. In fact, the words, thus I have heard, mean this is something that's been passed down through an oral tradition. And they specifically imply, I wasn't there at the time, but I have heard about it. That's what the words thus have I heard mean. Okay? And there are two Chinese versions of this sutta. Now, one of them found in the Majjhima Agama, 106, I mentioned before. Another one is an independent sutta, Taisho 56. And just to give a bit of background on the Chinese versions before coming on to talk more about the introduction, that the Majjhima Agama is the parallel collection to the Majjhima Nikaya and includes many of the same suttas, but with certain ones that are different. In addition to the main collection of the Majjhima Agama, which is like a full collection, we also find various isolated or independent collections, independent suttas, which are found at various places in the Chinese canon and sort of collected together. And these ones were translated, brought over from India to China at various times and then translated by various translators. This particular one was translated by Dharma Raksha during the period 256 to 316 AD. That's very early, and that's supposed to be one of the earliest of the translations of the Agama Sutras. Both of these collection, or both of these versions, place the sutta in Savati, Jeta's grove, okay, rather than at Ukata in the royal Sala tree. So here we have an interpretive problem, like what really happened. Presumably there was a real sutta given, and presumably it was at either one of these places. So where was the real sutta given, and which one's really right and which one's really not? Well, the first thing is, as soon as we notice that, is we realize, well, actually we really don't know. And so this is one of the great advantages of reading these things in comparative light, is that we begin to realize exactly how much we don't know and how much we take them for granted. If we just had one version, we looked at the Pali and it says it was at Ukata, and we say, fine, it was at Ukata. We don't have any perspective on that. Now we've got two other versions that say it was somewhere else. So then we have to look at that and think, well, which one is more reasonable? Now, if one of the principles for deciding this, in particular with the settings of the suttas, so there's a principle which we can call the Savati Normalization Redaction Principle. Okay, so I hope you remember that. The Savati Normalization Redaction Principle. And so that means that there are actually instructions given in at least two vinayas, in the Mahasanghika Vinaya and Mulasarvasivadin Vinaya, that tell the monks, what do you do when you forget where a sutta was taught? What do you do when you forget who was the actual laywoman that the Buddha was talking to? What do you do when you forget who was the king that the Buddha was talking to? And so if you forget where the sutta was, then you have to say it was at Savati. It doesn't quite say it that simply, but more or less that's what it ends up being. If you forget the laywoman, you say it was Visakha. If you forget who the king was, then you say it was either Pasenadi or Bimbisara, and so on and so forth. So this is how these things happened, and so this is no doubt, if you followed this principle, even to a moderate degree, then of course you'd end up with the vast majority of suttas being set in Savati, which is of course where the vast majority of them are. So what this means is that when we have alternatives, one of them set in Savati, other one set at another place, then we're more likely to consider that the other place is more authentic. The other interesting little detail to notice here, I just mentioned the Brahmanimantanika Sutta, Majjhima 49. Now in there, the Buddha starts out actually saying, the sutta starts out saying, the Blessed One was living in Savati in Jeta's grove. And then he addressed the bhikkhus and he said, once I was living at Ukata in the Subhaga grove at the foot of a royal sala tree. In other words, the sutta was actually, it has two settings. One is where it actually happened, and then the other was another time later when the Buddha was talking about it. And of course, it makes perfect sense, doesn't it? Why shouldn't the Buddha have given a teaching at one time, and then later on recalled that occasion, and then given the teaching again at another time? So in that case, perhaps both of these settings are right. Perhaps the original sutta was given at Ukata, and perhaps at a later time the Buddha might have recalled this and said and told the monks, oh, well, when I was at Ukata, such and such happened, and then later that becomes mistaken to be the place of the sutta. So these things are interesting, and these things actually relate to the subject of the sutta, which we will get round to eventually, I promise you, but which is about all about perception and about how our minds are like programmed to see things in certain ways. And so we're programmed to read things in certain ways. And this applies to how we read the suttas as well. So this is what I'm trying to do now, is I'm trying to like instantiate the sutta by deconstructing your perceptions before we actually read it. And so then we have this bit of saying, the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. Now, of course, when we read it in Pali, we say the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus. Bhikkhus, Lord, the bhikkhus replied. But of course, when it says bhikkhus, it doesn't say bhikkhus in Pali, it says bhikkhavo. And when it says Lord, it says bharante. Now, the interesting thing about this, as Venerable Analia notices, is that both of these forms are unusual, and they're not at all standard. Normally, when anybody addresses the monks, they use the form bhikkhave. Now, bhikkhave is what they call a Magadhism, which is like a more colloquial form. Usually, Magadhisms are regarded as being more likely to represent the actual language of the Buddha, or closer to the language of the Buddha. Bhikkhavo is a more kind of standardized Pali rendering, perhaps slightly Sanskritized, you might think. Similarly, bhante is not the usual form to as a polite address. Normally we use bhante, okay? So bhante is the normal polite address, but here it uses bhante, which again is a Sanskritized form. And that only appears in these little in-between bits in the introduction. They don't appear in the actual body of the sutta. So we've got like two different dialects being used, yeah? One dialect uses bhikkhave and bhante. It's more colloquial, more natural. The other one uses bhikkhavo and bharante. It's more formal and artificial. And again, that particular formal and artificial bit doesn't appear in the two Chinese suttas. Okay? So here we have a good concurrence of linguistic grammatical analysis and also comparative analysis. And so again, it seems likely that these kinds of slightly more formal openings were the product of the redactors rather than being the actual literal record of what happened. Okay? Any questions so far? All right. So, okay, finally come to the sutta itself. Here in Bhikkhu is an uninstructed worldling, Putujana, Asuruva Putujana, who is without regard for the Aryans, unskilled in the Dhamma of the Aryans, undisciplined in the Dhamma of the Aryans, who is without regard for the good men, unskilled in the Dhamma of the good men, undisciplined in the Dhamma of the good men. He perceives earth as earth. Having perceived earth as earth, he conceives earth, he conceives in earth, he conceives from earth, he conceives earth is mine. He delights in earth. What is the reason? Because it has not been fully understood by him, I declare. So here we have one of these typically cryptic sayings which we find in the suttas, and which obviously calls for a bit of unpacking. So here we have, of course, the uninstructed Putujana. Putujana, Bhikkhu Bodhi translates as worldling, which is kind of okay, but Ajahn Jayasaro commented it sounds a bit like kind of sci-fi kind of thing. You've got the kind of the earthlings and stuff, but Putujana, literally Putu means many, Jana means folk. So maybe like an ordinary person.
He says untaught ordinary person.
Untaught ordinary person, yeah. Asutava means literally not heard, as in not having heard the teachings.
Ordinary folk.
Yeah, ordinary folk, yeah. Plebs.
Yeah.
Westies.
Scum.
Ajahn Pasano suggested, or no, Ajahn Jayasaro suggested yo-yo. Because they always kind of spinning round and round and going up and down and they never get anywhere.
Right.
Bloke, perhaps. So, of course, this meaning somebody who has not realized the Dhamma, not a stream enterer or anything like that. And in the commentaries, it distinguishes between the kind of the, I'm not sure, I can't remember the term they use, but a kind of a basically an ignorant or stupid worldling, and then a kalyana, who uses the word kalyana, like a good ordinary person. So somebody who actually, you know, does listen to the Dhamma and makes efforts to practice and so on, even though they haven't seen it. But here it's talking about a very fundamental cognitive structure which applies to all Putujanas.
Yeah, interesting to notice that this part about the earth is actually directly what it says in there, but the opposite.
Exactly, yeah. So,
opposite.
More or less exactly So the and again, unskilled in the Dhamma of the Aryans. Of course, the Aryans being those on the eight pairs of noble ones, and the term Arya having a variety of connotations, and it's controversial to what degree it might have had a racial connotation. Ever since the 19th century, it's been the kind of the main thesis of Western Indologists has been that the Aryans were a people, like a race who originated, not quite sure where, perhaps in the Caucasus or somewhere, and moved west into Europe and south into Persia and east into India, and that the Brahmanical tradition is a leftover of that Aryan tradition. It's not sure to what extent that is actually justified. I mean, certainly there's a cultural transmission, but to what extent that's actually can be identified with a racial group is not at all certain. It's very controversial, one of these very highly politically charged elements in Indic history. And recently, one of the defining features of the Aryan people is, of course, they were supposed to have had fairer skin. And of course, in the north of India, people tend to have fairer skin. In the south of India, they tend to have darker skin. And so this was felt to be because of the Aryans mixing with the indigenous people. And the Indians themselves find this idea a bit revolting. And interestingly enough, the most recent research on that has come out, and that shows that there's actually the difference in skin color of peoples is consistent all around the world, and it is due to the distance from the equator and basically the heat of the sun. And as people live closer to the equator, their skin's naturally darker. And so that's not necessarily a racial feature at all. So obviously in Buddhism, if there was ever any racial connotation to the word Arya, then it is no longer relevant. And Aryan in Buddhism is just means the somebody who's noble, somebody who's very good, someone who's pure. So this Patujana perceives earth as earth. Having perceived earth as earth, he conceives earth, conceives in earth, conceives from earth. He conceives earth as mind. He delights in earth. And as Venerable Tapasi just pointed out, very, very similar to the passage in the Upanishads. I'll just have a look at that just more, a little bit more closely. Have a look at the exact difference. So the Pali, here says, first of all, Pataving Patavito Sanjanati, one perceives earth as earth. And the Upanishad passage says, Ya Pratavyang Tishtang, one standing in earth. Okay, so that's like the second one we have here. Pataving Patavito Sanyatwa, Pataving Manyati, Pataviya Manyati, one conceives in earth, is a locative form. It's like one standing in earth, or Prativya Antara. It says here, Prativya Shtitang, standing in earth, Prativya Antara, is inside earth, who the earth does not know, and of which the earth is his body. That's like someone who owns earth, or belongs to, or considers earth is theirs, and controls the earth from within. So they're very, very similar to the Pali passages, Pali phrases here. One perceives earth, conceives in earth, conceives from earth, and so on. Not exactly the same. It's probably the relationship is probably not close enough to make us confident that it was definitely referring to the same passage. But it certainly may have been. There's a kind of a whole genre of thinking and different ways of phrasing similar kinds of ideas. I haven't been through the Upanishads to look for other parallel passages. Certainly, it's a similar kind of thing. Now, if we look more in detail at this exact phrase, one thing I will remark straight away, which you won't get from Bhikkhu Bodhi's comments, is that this whole passage, which actually details that very interesting psychological and cognitive relationship of the knower with the object, okay, and this is one of the most interesting parts of the sutta, that's completely absent from the Chinese translations, right? Getting a few shocked looks here. So the Chinese, the Majjhima Agama version speaks instead of recluses and Brahmins who take earth to be the self, or earth being part of the self, or the self being part of earth. And the individual translation describes somewhat similarly how these recluses and Brahmins delight in earth and proclaim earth to be the self. So this whole cognitive analysis is found only in the Pali version and not found in the two Chinese versions. Why that might be so, I invite your speculations. I don't know. Interesting, though, isn't it? One of the most actual interesting parts of the sutta. Perhaps few possibilities. Perhaps to some extent, one problem is that this is very tightly bound up with grammar, which we'll find later, and it actually would be quite difficult to translate into Chinese. So perhaps this is one problem, is that the Chinese kind of blurred over the difficult Indic passages and simplified it because of translation difficulty. That's one possibility. Perhaps, again, it was a sutta which had particular importance within the Theravadan tradition. We remember the fact that the Theravadins put it at number one in the whole Majjhima. So it seems that they thought of it as very important, and whereas the Sarvasivadins buried it away at number 106, so perhaps they didn't think it was so important. So, and again, it's something of so importance, and this kind of psychological or cognitive analysis is reminiscent or has something in common with what we find in the Abhidhamma, so perhaps there's some relationship there.
A bit similar to the phrase, salt of the earth.
Salt of the earth?
An uneducated mate,
right.
Salt of the earth,
yeah.
Is having a perception which is not
right.
Correct.
Right. So
maybe it's like an idiom in that time role.
Oh, okay, maybe it's like an idiom, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like we use salt of the earth.
Yeah.
Or petugina.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
Because it's, you know, as you've got it in the Upanishad, later, a couple of hundred years later, the idiom has changed.
Yeah. Well, certainly it's part of trying to understand or conceive of oneself somehow, and in terms of various categories which they use, and so they're very used to using those categories. I mean, it's this whole kind of, you know, medicine and nutrition and everything in Indian philosophy, and that's all kind of uses the four elements. And so, it's definitely kind of an idiomatic, you know, you're using that framework to try to understand yourself with. Yeah. So, in the Pali, the key to this thing, Patavim Patavito Sanjanati, one perceives earth as earth. Having perceived earth as earth, one conceives earth. And so, and then conceives in earth, conceives from earth, conceives earth is mine, and then delights in. You've got this, like, very, very nice little sequence going here in the thing where it starts out quite innocuous. Like, what's the problem, you know? He sees his earth, perceives his earth. Like, what's the big deal, you know? And then it sort of goes on very, very subtly, sort of dragging you further in. And this is something that the Pali does in a few of the very interesting suttas. The Madhupindika Sutta is another one that does the same kind of thing. So perceiving it. Then the next one, conceiving. So there's a slight difference there. What's the difference between perceiving something and conceiving it? So, of course, when we think of these, we have to remember we're thinking of Pali or Indic words. Sanjanati, this sanya. Okay, so one first has this sanya of the earth. And so we have to, well, what does sanya mean? And sanya is always used, the best way of understanding sanya is actually from the Vinaya. And in the Vinaya, it's constantly used as a term for explaining how you do things basically without thinking that it's a certain way, but it's not really a certain way, or you see it's a certain way, but it's not. So if you perceive that the branch is dead when you break it, then it's no offense, even though you're not supposed to. It's actually alive when you break it, yeah. And so, or you perceive that something's not has been it's earth which is allowable for a monk to dig, and actually it's not. But you dig it anyway, so there's like a perception there. And then so this is like a factor. So you're seeing something in a way that's not necessarily how it might be. Of course, it might be that way, yeah? As in this case, you're perceiving earth, and it actually is earth, right? But it might not be. And so there's a sense in which there's this very kind of basic cognitive presuppositions to what we're seeing, or how experience is processed. And, you know, there's, of course, been a lot of work done in this field in modern psychology and sort of investigation of these kinds of things. And it's like a sorting. It's how you sort out the perceptual field and make sense of the perceptual field. This is how I understand sanya, that when we open our eyes and see that there's just a whole mess of information. There's just light. There's just this vast quantity of information which we can't actually make sense of. And so Sanya is the one which actually makes sense of that, filters it. And so Sanya is the one which distinguishes, you know, person from floor. How do you actually know that? How do you know there's a difference between a person and a floor? How do you know the difference between near and far? Yeah? How do you know the difference between certain colours or distinguish between certain objects? None of these are presented to you by the visual field itself. Okay? But these, and we know this from trying to do computer programs and so on. You know, we can take a photograph of something and you try to tell a computer, you know, take the person out of this photograph. Well, of course, a computer can't recognize it, doesn't have the sanya to be able to recognize. And that's one of the great challenges of computer software programming, is to develop pattern recognition. So it's maybe a very important way of understanding sanya is like pattern recognition and being able. So in doing that, sanya conglomerates things. Okay. So if I'm looking here, if I'm looking at that Bhante bobcat sitting there, and then there's this whole range of different things, different kinds of colours of his robes, his skin, his eyebrows, and so on, and the different shape and everything. And there's actually a vast quantity of information just coming there. And then my eye, somehow I know to tell the difference, okay, even though his sitting cloth he's sitting on is more or less the same colour, but I know very clearly what's the difference between his robe and his sitting cloth and so on. And this is presented to me automatically before I've even thought about it or got a label. So it's just like pre-labeling or pre-conceptual, but it's essential for actual developing conceptual things. So this is what I understand of sanya, the meaning of sanya here. So when seeing earth, you perceive earth as earth, then it's not the same as seeing. Okay, so it's not just the eye consciousness which is seeing it. It's actually a mental act which is perceiving the earth. Even though you're perceiving it correctly, but there's still that element of like filtering which is involved there. So pataving patavito sanyatva pataving manyati. So then we go to the next phrase. Having perceived earth as earth, one conceives earth. So the Pali word here manyati, and the word manyati in Pali like straddles two kind of ideas. One idea is to think of something, and the other idea is conceit or pride, thinking in terms of myself. So mana is word for pride, and manyati is sort of straddles that divide quite beautifully. And the Buddha is kind of playing on this similarity here. So when conceiving, then it's a more advanced stage of cognition. One no longer is simply recognizing, so we can think of. When we look at it, we recognize the earth is like the perception, but then to have the idea of it or conceive the idea of it is the conception, the manyati. And so it's a more advanced stage, and it's in that manyati that the self is starting to get more involved. Not consciously yet, but it's starting to get in there somehow.
Okay. Isn't it already distorted in the perception? I mean, isn't that not as distorted as the next stage?
Sure.
In that initial
marking,
it is this ignorance in that moment.
Yeah, sure. And you know, and you can think, if you want to have a look at that, Bhikkhu Bodhi talks about in terms of like the perversions of perception, you know, taking what is impermanent and seeing it as permanent, taking what is beautiful, seeing it as ugly, taking it as what is suffering, seeing it as pleasure, and taking what is self and seeing it as, so taking what is not self and seeing it as self. These are four perversions of perception. And so they're starting to work very, very subtly. You know, and they create, and you can see that these things do create ignorance. I mean, the classic example, I saw John Kabat-Zinn just a few weeks ago, and he did this thing with the gorilla and the basketball game. Have you seen that?
No.
And well, it's very, very, very funny, very amazing. Because I'd read about it beforehand. This is one of the disadvantages of being widely read, is that I knew the trick beforehand, so it didn't work for me. And I just kind of sat there, you know, and he just played this like 1 minute long video of these two groups of people playing basketball. And then there's this two, like four people, and they're just throwing a basketball. And you've got to find out, they're wearing different coloured shirts, and you've got to count how many times they pass the ball from one to the other, right? And how the red shirts pass it how many times, and the blue shirts pass it how many times, and you've got to count it how many times and I think you've got white and black shirts, and you've got to count how many times the white shirts pass the ball. So everyone's kind of sitting there counting it. And while in the middle of it, the thing, this man in this gorilla suit just walks on, and then sort of jumps up and down in front of the camera and beats his chest and then walks off again. It's just there. It's just like someone walks into the door here and then just jumps up and down, beats his chest and walks off again. And then at the end of it, you know, he just asks, did you see anything unusual, you know? And it goes like, you see, it was obvious, there's a man in a gorilla suit there. But no, hardly anyone saw it. It's like a room of 400 people. And there's almost nobody, there's nothing unusual. And then he said, okay, now I don't want you to count the passes, just watch the video now and see what happens, see if you notice anything unusual. And then he played it again. And then when the guy walked on the gorilla suit, everyone just started laughing. It's not the same thing. It's not the same video, you know. And I did it. And what was even more amazing is that some people didn't even see it the second time. Even then, they still didn't see it. And they're like, what? Oh, it's the man in the gorilla suit. I didn't see it. It's just amazing. Yeah. And these were all, you know, they're all professional people. They're all intelligent. They're all educated, they're all meditators, they're all supposed to be most of them were healthcare professionals, you know, who's after one, and psychologists and stuff, and very powerful demonstration. It's just so, I mean, we're used to the idea that we're shaped subtly by these things, but it's just in such a gross way to see how your perception is filtered. And you can see how even there, like that perception filtering is also from a sense of self involved there. You're asked to do a task, actually, which is not all that easy because they're running around and how many times they pass the ball, you have to use quite a degree of concentration. So, of course, there's self there to actually count it, you know. I want to get the number right, yeah. And because that involvement of self is there, then there's the filtering out of the other thing. Yeah, that was very good. That was that was like the highlight of his talk. He kind of built up to that whole thing in the talk. Great demonstration of ignorance. So, perceiving like that, then you conceive it. Okay, it's myself. Just conceiving it. Then, Patavya Manyati. So, this is a locative form. And locative form could mean literally conceived in earth. So, for example, if you think of your body as earth, you might think of myself as being like the little man the size of a thumb who lives inside my body. Okay, so that's a very crude or animistic way of thinking of the self. But also, padaviya also means in relation to self. Okay, so one conceives with reference to earth, yeah? Or one conceives about earth. Okay, so it can be used. So we're starting to get a bit more subtle in the way that we're dealing with things. Patavito manyati, one conceives from earth. And again, that can be understood in a very crude way. One could say, well, myself abides outside of my body, right? That's a very common kind of self theory, okay, which is not perhaps very common these days, but in the ancient world was extremely common. You can think of, for example, the Lord of the Rings. In the Lord of the Rings, the ring is Sauron's self. He's invested his soul in it, so that's why he can't live once the ring is destroyed. And so the ring is his soul, and that lives outside of his body. It's a very, very common idea, the external soul. In Padavya, but also Padavito, the ablative case could also mean, on a more subtle level, one conceives that it can be used in a causative sense. Okay, so it can be used causally. So it can mean that myself is, one conceives myself caused by or based on earth. Okay, this is another way of thinking about it. Or one could conceive one's. And it can also be used in the sense of an inference. So one could be inferring from earth to what the self is. Okay, so moving from is like an inference. So there's these different ways that these particular grammatical constructions can be construed. And, you know, as I was saying before, the suttas aren't telling us that one of these ways of looking at it is right and the other ways are wrong. But they are opening up various different ways of investigating. Then the next one, Patavang Meti Manyati. Now here, it's starting to move a little bit further along. Patavang Meti, earth is mine. And then it says Ti, which is inverted commas. Okay? So here we have what's more like a consciously constructed idea. It's actually a thought. We actually have a thought or an idea or a theory that earth is mine. So whereas before it was more like a cognitive presupposition, and now we have like a consciously conceived idea of earth as the self. And then the last one, of course, one delights in earth. And so here, craving comes to the foremost, and one is actually like indulging in earth as being that which is going to bring me happiness. It becomes like earth is like an instrumental thing. It's that which is going to make me happy.
So what you're saying here is it's a sequence of identifying with that object.
Yeah. I see, which it becomes more and more subtle or more and more ingrained as it goes along. Moves from just a basic cognitive perception.
So it's going from I am to I am that to grasping onto it.
Exactly, yeah. More and more. But it's just expressed so subtly, is why these sort of,
especially that movement from what you're saying, from just marking something as earth to seeing it as an instrument of pleasure.
Right.
So it's like that whole movement, because that's the ultimate distortion, when you're seeing something as an instrument of pleasure.
Conception you can see is some kind of thought process or thinking about it or pondering it. Is that correct?
The conceiving or the manyati in it, again, it might have a bit of a spectrum. Yeah, it might be like having might not be like having a reflective thought about it, but forming an idea about it, which can become conscious and reflected on as a thought. Yeah. So maybe thinking in the same in a very broad sense. Yeah. So like thinking about it in a very broad sense. We often.
He can see himself as earth, so you have to think about that.
That's right, yeah.
So that comes from the perception that you...
Exactly, yeah. And so you have to... That perception is necessary before you can start forming those more advanced concepts.
And thus there's the four perversions of perception.
Yeah.
Because the perception comes as present, then you conceive or you think about that.
Yeah. And... Exactly. Yeah, that's the bait, yeah, the pleasure of it. But in this context, the emphasis really is about self and not self. That's the most basic idea it's talking about here.
Is this conceived the same as the English, like the in Pali, is it the same as what it would be in the English dictionary?
Similar. It's not bad. I mean, this is why Nyanamoli and Bhikkhu Bodhi have chosen this kind of idea, but if we kind of remember that it has that twofold idea of both thinking about something and also pride and conceit. So concept and conceit, yeah?
Because what is it? Manyati.
Manyati, yeah.
That's a reference to
that. It is, yeah. It's like mana, yeah, from the same root.
So when you say that tapati, what I like about your description is sort of the unconsciousness of the conceiving process or the fear. It's not that someone is so fully conscious that they're thinking of it, but that the idea of the ignorance behind perceiving it in a distorted way is operating.
Yeah.
So it's conception in that sense, but not that there's a full awareness of it.
Right.
Oh, this is the I live part of the earth and I don't live as part of the earth.
And that and
I'm a part of
the earth. Right. Absolutely, and that only becomes fully conscious when it says patavim meti manyati. So then the ti implies that there's an actual sort of reflective idea. So before that, you can think of it as like pre-conscious or subconscious or something. Yeah. But it's emerging. It's like emerging into consciousness. Yeah. Very beautiful, very subtle, and I find it's very disappointing. Why don't the Chinese versions have that? Is this just an invention of the Abhidhamma scholars? I'm very disappointed by it. And I would really like it if they had the same thing, but there you go, they don't. So what can I say? So what is the reason for that? Tanki se hetu, prinyatang tasati wadami. Because what's the reason for that? Because he doesn't fully understand it. Okay? So here the word prinyata. And again, notice the subtlety with which these things are phrased. We have the same root is the root nya, meaning to know. Now we have the same root sanjanati or sanya, which is what he is doing. Now we have parinya, the same root but a different prefix. And so the sanya, the implication or the suggestion of the sun in sanya is bringing things together. So seeing holes, okay? So sanya sees holes. So it'll see like a chair, a whole chair. It'll see like a whole mat. It'll see a whole wall, and it'll put disparate things together and see it as a whole. That's the suggestion or the implication. Pari means all around. Okay, so it's the same root as in English perimeter. Yeah, all the way around, or per as in pervade. Yeah, all the way through something, all the way around something, or all the way through it. So it's not just sanya tends to kind of bounce off the surface of things a bit, whereas parinya tends wants to go through it and see and absorb through it and see the whole thing. So he has the sanya, but doesn't have the parinya to see right through it.
Get into Namarupa from here.
Oh, we could go straight into Namarupa. So then the sutta goes on to a list of things. Now, the Brihadaranyaka in its corresponding thing also has a list of things. Yeah? Water, air, heaven, sun, space, moon and stars, various devas and so on. And a slightly different list of things in the Pali. Again, a somewhat different list of things in the Chinese versions. I don't know if Analia, she gives the Analia doesn't give the whole list of things. Let's see, it has here, I think Thichmen Chao gives us the list of things, at least in the Madhyama Agama version. So the list here from the first, from the Madhyama Agama version. Earth, water, fire, wind, spirits, devas, the Prajapati, Brahma, the no worry plane.
Sounds like my
Australian. Yeah, it could have been. Maybe this was the Australian ascension, I don't know. Yeah. The no worries plane, the no distress plane, purity, plane of infinite space, plane of infinite consciousness, of nothingness, neither perception nor non-perception, oneness, diversity, plurality, the seen, heard, sensed, cognized, the obtained, the contemplated, mindfulness, thought, from this world to that world, from that world to this world, and all. Okay, finishing off with all. So as we can see there, it has certain similarities with the Pali list, and also certain striking differences. I'll talk about some of the differences a little bit later on. But I won't go into all of these things, obviously. It will take a little bit too much time to talk about all of them. But we can see certain kinds of things appearing here. Now, within each of these items in the list, then the sutta repeats the same formula. The uninstructed Patujana sort of processes their perceptions or their seeing of all of these things in the same way, and thus leading up to delighting and deluding and being deluded and so on and so forth. The actual list of things in the Pali, according to Bhikkhu Bodhi's translation, we have earth, water, fire, air, beings, gods, which is devas, Prajapati, we see creator god in Brahmanism, Brahma, also a creator god, the gods of streaming radiance, Abhasara. So here you see gods produced by the second jhana. The Brahma is usually produced from the first jhana. Prajapati doesn't have a particular place within the Buddhist scheme of things. He doesn't occur so often. And actually, Prajapati is quite a, as it mentions in the note, thank you, is quite a ancient deity, and he's got this kind of even a slightly ambiguous place even within the Brahmanical tradition as well. He tended to get replaced by the later gods. The Subakina devas, the Vehapala devas, the Abhibhu, to do with the fourth jhana, and the base of infinite space, infinite consciousness, and nothingness, and neither perception nor non-perception. So here, first of all, we have the basic material elements, and here going through this kind of this sequence of the Buddhist cosmology up through the devas and up to the highest level of neither perception nor non-perception, and at each stage the Patujana would delight in those things in the same way. So interestingly enough, we've gone from this is like the samatha, if you like, the samatha scheme, and we now go to what we think of as the vipassana ideas. He's now thinking of the seen, the heard, the sensed, and the cognized, of course, as being a set, which is taught very often in some of the vipassana teachings, like the teachings to Bahia. Just a couple of notes on this particular sequence. What is seen, what is heard, what is sensed. Now, Bhikkhu Bodhi is following the commentary here, which identifies the sense is mutta. He identifies it with what is smelt, tasted and touched, i.e. the three physical senses not covered by seen and heard. This is I think, certainly not correct. And mutta is never means to be sensed, and it means thought, okay, or conceived. It's actually the same root as we've had manyati before. And vinyata is cognized. So this set of seen, heard, sensed, and cognized, we've heard several times before already today in the reading from the Brihadaranyaka, and this is exactly the way that Yajnavalkya is phrasing himself. He's the unseen seer, the unheard hearer, the unthought thinker, the uncognized cognizer. So he's using exactly the same kind of terminology. So this is lifted directly out of the Upanishads. The next one, unity as unity, diversity as diversity. So this is so here we've moved from, we've moved from the physical stuff through the realms of the gods up to the highest level, and especially through the jhana attainments, and then the empirical, the sensory realm, seen, heard, sense, and cognize. I might also mention here, I should have mentioned that earlier, sorry, with the seen, heard, thought, and cognize. This also has a great importance for epistemology, and this was pointed out by Jayati Leka, that these are these are different ways of knowing. Okay, so one can know by seeing something. So I saw it. That's why I know it. You can know by hearing, which usually means hearing an oral tradition. So this is what the heard here mainly, or one of the implications of it is to say this is what I've heard. It's what's been passed down by the tradition. And the thought, of course, being I know something because I've reasoned it out. Yeah, say like Socrates, he would say I know something because I've thought it. So that would be the mutta. And then the cognized is to be aware of something. Okay, and this would refer to largely to sort of yogic experience, samadhi experience, where you actually have this consciousness of something. So these are different ways of knowing or coming to knowledge about the world. So unity and diversity, of course, this being a great duality, and elsewhere the Buddha treats these things as a duality and dependent origination as being the escape from these things. So of course the tendency within the Brahmanical tradition is to move towards seeing things as a unity. Okay, the tendency within certain other traditions, especially the Jaina tradition, and to some extent within the Abhidhamma tradition of Buddhism, was to see things as a diversity. So that tendency was to see that reality consists of a number of discrete or different things or elements, and that the world is built up or is constructed out of that. And so there's that kind of tendency, as opposed to the tendency towards unity, which you find in the non-dual traditions. Okay? And the last one, perceives all as all. Again, very similar to the idea of perceiving unity, but it's more like a kind of a pantheistic idea where you see God is in everything, or the divinity is in everything. Okay, so seeing all. And again, you're very close to that idea of the tadvangasi, thou art that. It's important to notice this because it has been claimed by a whole generation of Pali scholars from Carolyn Rice Davies onwards for like 50 years that Buddhism basically taught the same sort of self-doctrine, pantheistic self-doctrine of the Upanishads, and that there was no place where the Buddha sort of criticized ideas of a limited self, but never criticized this idea of the pantheistic self, the self that is the same as the cosmos. And this kind of idea was very popular for many years, and certainly was very popular among certain Hindu philosophers, among whom the learned Radhakrishnan, who translated this book, and many others. But at least in terms of textuality, it's certainly incorrect, because there are cases like this and many other cases where the Buddha refers to doctrines that can only have been those pantheistic ideas. The clearest one is probably a place where he refers to so atta so loko in the Majjhima Nikaya. We'll find that later, where the self is identical with the world, which obviously is referring to the similar kinds of ideas which we found in Yajnavalkya. Okay. Then,
this is a good one.
He perceives Nibbana as Nibbana. having perceived Nibbana as Nibbana, he conceives Nibbana. He conceives in Nibbana. He conceives from Nibbana. He conceives Nibbana is mine. He delights in Nibbana. What is the reason? Because it is not being fully understood by him, I declare. So, what does this mean? So, much has been the ink that has been spilled over this. Many have been the coffee table discussions about the implications of this, and few have been those who have even bothered to check that the Chinese, both the Chinese versions, do not mention Nibbana in this context. So this is a classic example where if we're going to be talking about these things, let's at least do it by informing ourselves of what the text actually has or says before getting too excited about having an idea about what it might mean one way or the other. So the fact that the Chinese doesn't mention Nibbana here, of course, doesn't prove anything, but it certainly does make one a little bit more cautious about reaching any great conclusions about what exactly is meant here. So the commentarial explanation is that Nibbana here doesn't refer to real Nibbana, but it refers to the five kinds of Nibbana here and now, which are talked about in the Brahmajala Sutta, which is sensual pleasures is one, and then the four jhanas are the other four. And so this is the Patujana who's conceiving these five kinds of Nibbana here and now. So that kind of makes sense for the Patujana. Unfortunately, it also says the same thing we'll read later for the Sekha, that is for the stream enterer, once returner or non-returner, who also apparently directly knows Nibbana as Nibbana, still is exhorted to not conceive Nibbana and so on and so forth. And so it doesn't seem to make so much sense in that context. If he already knows it directly, then one could hardly, he could, as a stream enterer or something, he could hardly be directly knowing the what Ajahn Brahm calls banana Nibbana. So it must have been the real thing in the case of the Sekha, at least. So
Bhante,
what do you reckon, Dave?
Mentioned earlier, the jhanas are mentioned earlier anyway.
The jhanas are mentioned earlier anyway, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So
there must be a state which is beyond Nibbana.
There must be a state which is beyond Nibbana. Careful what you say, lest your head is going to fall off.
This is the inferior Hinayana
Nibbana. The Hinayana Nibbana.
Fake one, the selfish arahants get stuck in.
Yeah, well, that's interesting that you should say that, because Thich Nhat Hanh actually takes that suggestion very seriously. And I'll talk about that a little bit more later, but actually that he does suggest that there is some similarity to this idea that it's quite common in the Mahayana Sutras to teach, you know, don't get attached to Nibbana. Yeah, and this kind of idea is, you know, don't identify with Nibbana. And from a early Buddhist perspective, it's a bit kind of weird. Like, how can you get attached to it? It is the ending of attachment. And so, how can you get attached to the ending of attachment? Of course, you can get attached to the idea of it. Yeah, or even beforehand, you can be attached to the idea of it. But so anyway, it's interesting. It's where it sort of takes it up to the all, and up to there we've gone up to the limit of philosophy, if you like, the limit of understanding the world, you know, and these kind of very, very sublime Upanishadic ideas, which are very beautiful philosophical theories. And then we've taken it one step further, and that step is quite interesting. So we've noticed a couple of interesting differences from the Chinese to the Pali, both the absence of the cognitive analysis and also the absence of Nibbana, both of those quite striking. Now, another difference is that the Chinese versions both speak of the initial stage, speaks of the recluses and Brahmins who fall prey to conceivings, which we've just dealt with. Then they go on to those of their wiser counterparts who do not get involved in conceivings, due to be endowed with understanding. And then they apply the same to the Buddha. So they only have three cases, one who conceives, one who doesn't conceive, and then the Buddha, whereas the Pali has several more cases. And again, perhaps also suggestive of more importance being given to this sutta in the Pali tradition. But these differences, especially the case of the Sekha, is very interesting, that in between position that they have, that has that kind of ambiguity, which is actually also a very interesting part of the sutra, and it's a bit of a shame that's not found in the Chinese. So let's have a look at what the says about the Seka. So again, just to remind you that the Seka means any, basically all of the noble ones apart from the Arahant. So the bhikkhu who is a learner, Seka, who has not attained his heart's ideal but is still yearning for the supreme security from bondage. Okay, he directly knows earth as earth. Okay, so here instead of perceiving earth as earth, we have directly knowing, abhijanati. And so we've had so far three words derived from the same root, janati. One is sanjanati, to perceive. And we've had parijanati, okay, to know fully. It's like the end result. And now like an in-between one, abhijanati. And so abhijanati obviously refers to a more direct and precise way of knowing. But not necessarily one which is for the full understanding of parijanati. So that kind of direct knowing, which is often, of course, called yathabhuta jnana dasana, the knowledge and vision of things as they are or things as they have become. And this is usually associated with the moment of stream entry in the suttas. Having directly known... Sorry? Having directly known earth as earth, having directly known earth as earth, let him not conceive earth, let him not conceive in earth, let him not conceive from earth. Let him not conceive earth is mine, let him not delight in earth. What is the reason? In order that he may fully understand it, I declare. So here we have quite this this interesting difference. Is ma manye, it's expressed in aorist sense. Ma mani, this is prohibition. So again, this is why the Seka is the Seka. He's the trainee. He's training himself. Do not see it in this way. So he has this kind of ambiguous position where he doesn't, if he chooses not to, choose to see something correctly, then he won't. But if he lets his mindfulness lapse, and he will actually see it the wrong way and can still get drawn back into those kind of worldly perceptions. So this seems to be the state of the Seka, is that they can still go under the sway of these kinds of the perversions of perception, but when they reflect on it, then they're able to see beyond that. Okay. So I mean, a classic example of this would be the Visakha, when she came to the Buddha weeping and crying because she'd lost her, I think lost her daughter or something like that, and the Buddha said, you know, would you like to have more daughters like that one? Grandchildren or something like that. Yeah, grandchild, granddaughter. And she said, oh, I'd love to have as many granddaughters as in the whole city of Sarvati. And the Buddha said, well, would there be a single day when you were not weeping and crying because they passed away? Yeah. And so then she understood. But, you know, she obviously got emotionally overtaken and so then needed that space. But when she was able to reflect, then it fell away. But there's still that gap. A similar thing happened with Ananda. And, you know, various times, and he got confused or, you know, started crying or all these kinds of things. But then he's able to reflect on it and to understand. So this is the Seka. And the interesting thing here is also says, Parinyeyang tasati vadami. So this word Parinyeya, those of us who've been chanting the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta would remember, would recognize, yeah, the Parinyeya is in the First Noble Truth, yeah? Yeah, one should to be fully known, yeah? So this Noble Truth of Dukkha is to be fully known. And that's very important because, like the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the more and more I study the suttas, the more it seems to me, you know, how important that sutta is as like the key or the framework for all the suttas and all the teachings. And so here you've got this, actually the same word. Yeah, it's like a key word, which is almost like referring you back to that same context. And both of those contexts can help to illuminate it. So, to be fully known. Yeah. So this was that those three, what they call the Tiparivatta, the three rounds in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the First Noble Truth. The First Noble Truth is to be fully known, and the First Noble Truth has been fully known. Yeah. And then similar formulas apply to each of the Four Noble Truths. So this to be fully known also is like that ambiguous state. Yeah. It's been seen, but it's still to be fully known, and then has been fully known. Now this here, this is an interesting Buddhological point. Here, this Parinyeya is clearly meant to be the Seka, so it applies to the stream entry, once returner and non-returner. But in the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the Buddha is talking about it referring to himself. Yeah? So does that imply that the Buddha had to go through those paths of being a stream enterer, a once returner, and non-returner? Is that what parinyaya means? That when it says idang dukkhanti, it means the moment of stream entry, and then parinyaya is to be fully understood, the period of time when he was striving to fully understand it, and then parinyata is when he realized full enlightenment. This is a controversial Buddhological point, whether the Buddha had to actually go through these four paths.
So really it's that knowing, it's why he's saying we're talking about the purity of knowing.
Yeah, purity, depth, clarity. Yeah.
In perceiving.
Yeah. And that pari. You also have the abhijanati. Abhijanati is like higher knowledge you already have, but then the pari all the way through. Yeah. So it's interesting that that's the first noble truth is parinyaya. So dukkha is not to be repressed or ignored or escaped from. It's to be fully known, unfortunately. Yeah. It's one of the drawbacks of Buddhism. They don't necessarily tell you about in Buddhism 101. That dukkha is to be fully known. Oh. So, next one is the arahant. Bhikkhu is an arahant, a cankerless saint without cankers. Does anybody here have cankers? Probably. I'll pick up a six pack of cankers from down in the. So, I don't know where this word canker has actually come from. Of course, it's kinasava, is with defilements ended.
Is outflow?
Yeah, outflow or inflow or. Something like that. Anyway, the next sutra is a Sabhasava sutra, so we can talk about it more there. Lived the holy life, done what had to be done, laid down the burden, attained his own goal, eliminated the fetters of existence, and is emancipated through final knowledge. He directly knows earth as earth, and does not conceive earth, does not conceive in earth, does not conceive from earth, does not conceive earth is mine. He does not delight in earth. What is the reason? Because it has been fully understood by him, I declare. So then it repeats for the arahant three more times, adding that he is free of lust through the destruction of lust, free of hatred through the destruction of hate, free of delusion through the destruction of delusion. And of course this making perfect sense within the context of the sutta, that, you know, we do, you know, perceive things differently when we have you know, greed, hatred, and delusion, and these are actually what cause us to see things. If you're in love with somebody, you see them completely differently from how other people see them. If you hate somebody, then of course that will totally change your perception of them. If you're deluded, and then again, this will, you know, like the man in the gorilla suit example, is like delusion will completely change your perception of things. So it makes perfect sense to talk about those things, and yet in the Chinese versions, these are also absent. Then it talks about the Tathagata and then mentions that the same thing for the Tathagata, does not conceive these things because it has been fully understood to the end by the Tathagata. Okay? Parinyanantang or something like that. To be fully understood to the end. Although the text I have here, the PTS version, doesn't have that reading. It just says fully understood. Whether that reading is valid or not, I'm not sure. So,
you see the in the different Pali words for understood is that you've been talking about.
Yeah. First one, sanya. Okay, it's a noun form, the verb form sanjanati, is to perceive. Then abhinya, noun form, or abhijanati is the verb form, to directly know something. So that's usually used either to describe like stream entry or like the six abhinyas, like the six higher knowledges, also called abhinya. And then parinya or parijanati, to fully know something, know it all the way through, which is almost always used to mean, specifically to mean arahantship. Just seeing if this has this, my PTS text here doesn't have the reading. Just checking.
Yes, the notes is that it's used,
doesn't have it. It does have in the variant readings. It does have in the variant readings, Parinya Tantang. So whether that's authentic, I don't think the Chinese have it either. So in any case, like I guess a reference to the kind of the depth of understanding of the Tathagata. And then the slightly more interesting one, the next one, because again, he does not understand, he does not conceive these things. What is the reason? Because he has understood that delight is the root of suffering, and that with existence as condition there is birth, and that for what has come to be there is aging and death. Therefore, because through the complete destruction, fading away, cessation, abandoning and relinquishing of all cravings, the Tathagata has awakened to the supreme perfect enlightenment, I declare. So here, giving a very succinct, very brief summary of dependent origination, one of the most concise descriptions of dependent origination in the whole canon. So delight is the root of suffering, delight being equivalent to craving and grasping, tanha and upadana in dependent origination, existence being bhava and then birth. So there's that little sequence from dependent origination. I won't talk too much about that now because there's other suttas devoted entirely to dependent origination, but this is sort of brought in here.
So what did you say delight
meant? Delight, Nandi, is that idea before that we mentioned about using other things, where other things are used as an instrument for your pleasure. That's really what Nandi means. It means seeing the world as an instrument for your pleasure. Yeah? And so it's equivalent to like craving and grasping. Yeah. So it has that specific tone. Like delight, delight can be used in different senses in Pali. Like in the ending to a sutta, it also says those bhikkhus delighted in the Blessed One's words. So there it's used in just an ordinary sense. It doesn't have that implication. But where it's used in this kind of sense, that's what it means. Yeah.
Would you say that it's more like seeing the world for our preferences? It's like mm-hmm. the very beginning of that making a distinction rather than seeing things as they really are. Oh, I like that, so that in that liking there's that at the same time the movement marking the thing in a slightly distorted way through the preference.
Yeah, sure, yeah.
So that movement towards...
You start painting that in this kind of glow,
right.
Kind of rosy glow
right.
around the one that you like.
Mm, yeah. And then the craving is that movement, the continuing movement towards it.
Yeah, yeah. So this spoke the Exalted One. Those bhikkhus did not delight in the word of the Exalted One. So, why didn't the bhikkhus like what the Buddha said? This is again a very controversial point. Deeply controversial, and again many have been the coffee table discussions over this one.
And what did the Chinese say?
Chinese have the bhikkhus delighted in the Blessed One.
And can we just go back? Do the two Chinese versions follow these paragraphs? Do they have all the things?
With the,
like the arahant and the...
No, they just have three. They have the one who doesn't conceive. Sorry, who conceives, the one who doesn't conceive, and then the Buddha. Yeah, so much simpler.
And so they miss out that destruction of lust, destruction of hate.
Yep. Yep, yep.
These are obviously the selfish arahants who were attached to the Nirvana.
Well, quite possible, but just the commentary says that the audience was this group of ex-Brahmins, learned Brahmins, who were very conceited about their knowledge. When they heard what the Buddha explained, they didn't understand it, and so they were a bit annoyed. And later on, according to this, the Buddha taught another sutta, which is the what's it called? The Gotamaka Sutta, which is a very brief sutta, and it's quite an interesting one, but it's given a very brief, simple sutta, and at the end of it, the 10,000-fold world system was supposed to have shaken, which is quite an extraordinary thing to happen. And then that sutta, the Buddha basically just exhorts them to have faith in the Triple Gem. Really, there's nothing much more to it. And so the commentary says that The Brahmins were annoyed with this particular sutta, but the Buddha kind of shook them up, and then later kind of he exhorted them to have faith in the Triple Gem, and then that's what they all became arahants after listening to that. Other sutta, the Gotamaka Sutta. The alternative explanation suggested by, I think originally by Nyanananda, and followed up by Bhikkhu Bodhi and Analia, was that not that the Brahmins didn't understand what the Buddha was talking about, but they understood it all too well. And that the Buddha was deliberately having a go at their own kind of Brahmanical texts and ideas, and that it was precisely because they did recognize it and didn't understand it that they were annoyed at what the Buddha said. So this is another possible explanation. Of course, both of them might be wrong, that maybe the bhikkhus really did delight in them in the Buddha's talk, and perhaps na has been crept in there somehow. And there's one principle in textual criticism, which is that the difficult reading is to be preferred. Okay, so what that implies is that when people are copying or reciting or editing a text, they tend to make it more normal. They tend to make it more comprehensible, and so they will tend to, when faced with a difficult reading, one they don't recognize, they'll tend to turn it into one that they do recognize. So if you're faced with two alternative readings, one of which is more normal and one of which is less, more difficult, then you prefer the more difficult one. This is a rule of thumb which is used by textual critics. Of course, it's not meant to be a hard and fast rule, but it's like a rule of thumb. So under that rule, then you might prefer the reading that the bhikkhus did not delight, because this is a very unusual, in fact, probably unique reading.
Is this one the only
I think it's the only one, yeah. Only one in the whole canon. Now, Bhikkhu Thiknin Chao has an interesting comment here. According to the Sinhalese tradition, the monks were not pleased with this discourse. But the Pali Text Society edition and the Chinese version adopt the usual conclusion, mentioning that the monks were delighted in the Buddha's speech. From the unusual conclusion of this discourse, from the distinction between the Tathagata and the Arahant, so Thikmin Chao is referring to what he's commented on before, that in this sutta tends to stress, or this is his opinion anyway, I'm not sure whether it's correct, but he tends to stress, this sutta tends to stress the difference in attainment or understanding between the Buddha and the Arahant, which is perhaps less characteristic of the Pali sutras and more characteristic of Mahayana sutras. Okay? So, from the unusual ending, the distinction between the Tathagata and the Arahant, and the idea not to cling even to Nibbana in this discourse, which we've discussed before, can we consider this sutta, which bears some Mahayanist spirit, as one of those rare suttas which escaped the vigilance of the Theravada compilers and was included in the Pali Tipitaka, possibly by mere inadvertence? Okay? So this is...
like the Lotus Sutra, where the 500 Arahants walk out.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He's talking about attachment. And
yeah. And yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Maybe it's that was those ideas like taken from that.
Yeah, it's like a precursor, yeah.
Or vice versa, or then it could be just a grammatical thing.
Yeah, it's interesting. There is... And he has another interesting suggestion here. There is a possibility that the addition of the term na, okay, as in na abhinandun, did not delight, might have been used to earmark this sutta's expunging from the Pali Tipitaka, but the later Pali compilers forgot to do so. So what he's suggesting is that some scribe some editor, when they were going through the editing, he thought, no, this sutta doesn't work, I'll just write na on this one, which means exactly the same in Pali as it does in Australian. Nut means nut. We're not having this one. And and that later on they didn't realize, and so they thought it was actually part of the text. That's kind of very, very speculative, perhaps not hugely plausible, but an interesting little reflection. You do find similar marks on Sutta manuscripts and on the Gandhari manuscript, which have been recovered from Afghanistan recently. They have, you know, these are very kind of broken up old manuscripts, they're 2,000 years old, and on them you have a thing, likhita, or likhitang, or some version of that, which means written, okay? And that's like scratched in random on a different, with a different ink and a different handwriting on places in the manuscript, and it just says written in there. And what it seems to be, after researching this for some time, they've come to the conclusion that it was almost like a mark that was written by the scribe who had copied, and it actually means copied. So when the old manuscript had been used too much, was getting too old, they copied it out again, and then they wrote copied, they wrote likhita on the old one, and then stuck it in a jar, and then put the new one in the monastery library. And it's those old ones which are worn out and abandoned which have actually survived, and which we have.
Please talks when When were they written down? Were they written down on the occasion of the discourse, or were they given written down time after where they recalled?
They were passed down from oral tradition for maybe 400 years, mm-hmm. and written down. The Pali tradition records that the texts were written down about 20 BC. Okay, so the Buddha died in probably 420 BC. So that's, there probably were individual suttas that were written down earlier than that, but this is the first time we've actually got a date when it was said that the entire canon was written down.
So for 400 years they were passed down orally.
Yep.
And how many monks or whatever would have been present at, say, this one? Is there anything given or?
Usually not. I mean, this one, because it is a sutta of importance, and you could assume in that kind of sutta that there probably was quite a group of monks, probably nuns and probably lay people there as well, quite possibly. Maybe not lay people for a sutta like this. This is more of so not sure, but probably monks and possibly nuns as well. And I think normally, especially later in his life, the Buddha would have been speaking to quite large groups. It wouldn't have been just, sometimes it was just talking to individuals, but a lot of time there would have been quite a few people.
And this sort of, when was it given? Was it one of the early ones, or was it?
Not sure at all. There's no dates given within the suttas. Sometimes you can deduce from internal evidence within the sutta itself. This particular one, I don't know if there's anything that you could deduce. I'll just see if commentary says anything. Even the commentary doesn't really say anything about the date that it was taught, so it really could have been any time. Yeah. I don't even know where this place is, Ukata, Subhaga Grove, I don't know where it is.
So it seems to be a big step there from the perception of something to directly knowing it.
Exactly, and this particular sutta is concerned to define that, and to show, well, this is the difference. But this particular sutta is not telling you how to do that, right? So that's in the other the teachings elsewhere. So this is more kind of on the understanding level or the psychological level to actually understand how is that cognitive process working. Yeah.
Thank you. Really. I have just one question.
Yep.
About something you said earlier on about how to understand the sutras, because I've come to the sutras often from my own practice and understood them through my practice, like the difference of perception and sort of backtracking the mind and seeing what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to clarify when you said not to read the sutras from one's experience, exactly what you meant.
Of course I don't mean don't read the sutras from your own experience, but what I mean is more like to be careful, to be cautious about how you do that. And to be aware of exactly the kinds of things that it's talking there in the Mulapariyaya Sutta, where you are going to perceive certain things that are going to be unconsciously read into those things without you even knowing it. An obvious example here being simply the choice of language and terminology. We read perceive. Now that is a perception that's in our mind. Perceive. What does that mean? And then that's conditioned by our whole language, what we've learned as kids, what we've learned later, we've been studying, we've been reading different kinds of things, philosophy, psychology, blah, 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 blah. And we have an idea of what perceive means. And so that informs how we've read that. The very fact that word has been chosen is a controversial choice. Other translators choose different words, and they have good reasons for it. And the other different words might be quite different. Like somebody might choose recognition for sanya, which has a certain... It's not a bad choice, yeah? But then it's starting to think, oh, it's actually quite changing the way you're looking at it quite a lot. So then you realize that our very choices of words are conditioned by our intellectual background, yeah? And so so then you realize actually it's important to look at what was the intellectual background to the to these choices of actual words. So this is when you realize it's important to go back to the Pali, look at it in context and things like that. So I think it's not so much that you don't look at it in terms of your experience, but that you spend some time to put that to one side at the beginning and like try to deconstruct things, you know, and look at it in the context and so on, get some kind of idea and then to take it and look at it with your experience. Or at least, you know, you can look at an experience from the beginning, but to do so very tentatively and very, very openly, yeah?
Open to the whole exploration.
Yeah.
Because otherwise it seems to me you can just get involved in academic
dialogue. Of course.
If it's not rooted in practice.
Of course, yeah.
You know, but what I hear saying is until you are an arahant, hold the question mark.
Yeah.
Hold that investigation and openness.
Oh, well, Ajahn Chah said, when you become an arahant, that's even more uncertain.
Okay. Well, I mean, just that there's the clarity when delusion is being purified, the clarity of perception and conception means one understands.
Yes, sure, yeah.
There's more confidence in how you understand things.
Yeah.
That's what I hear you saying.
Absolutely. And it also depends on the audience as well. I mean, one of the reasons why I stress this is because within my tradition, with the Ajahn Chah tradition, and probably within practice traditions in Buddhism generally, that there's been a very poor level of engagement and understanding of the suttas. And so I'd like to try to encourage a bit more reflection and intelligence about how we're doing that. If I was talking to an academic audience, you know, I'd probably sort of stress the exact opposite, you know? So, yeah.
Patipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sangha.